So kind of open us up in prayer.
Yes. Father, heaven, Lord, thank you that we've come together this evening. You're so good to us to let us be able to meet like this, Lord. Just ask you to be with us as with this and the pastor teach us out of the Bible, out of his word, and we hear about what Job has to say, and I pray, Lord, that you will give us the ability to concentrate on what it is that we're hearing, and that you will give us good questions to ask, Lord, also to help us to understand, that it would go down deep into us and give us a changed life, and for those that need a changed person, Father, and we thank you for what you've done and what you're going to do. We thank you for the fellowship
that will
come afterwards. In the
name of Christ, amen. All right, everybody. We're in Job chapter 16.
Now, we just started, or did we cover one?
We're just starting. It's also known as the 16th chapter of Job.
Just great. As you were, Pastor.
I think that's
exactly
like
how he was.
Oh, okay. Can I just simply say that was the best response I think Rand's ever given to something like that the pastor said?
Uh-huh. All right. So Job chapter 16. Eliphaz has answered Job. And if we noticed last week, they're starting to get a little more snippy with each other. Okay. Not that we ever do that with each other, but
no,
they do. All right. All right. Then Job answered and said, I have heard many such things. Miserable comforters are ye all. You got that, Randy? He said, all right, miserable comforters are ye all. Shall vain words have an end? Or what emboldeneth thee that thou answerest? Okay, vain words, you know, in other words, your miserable comforters are just vain words. Are they ever going to have an end to it? Where'd you ever get the boldness to answer me? All right. I also could speak as you do, if your soul were in my soul's stead. I could heap up words against you and shake mine head at you. But I would strengthen you with my mouth, and the move of my lips would assuage your grief. Though I speak, my grief is not assuaged. And though I forbear, what am I eased? But now hath he made me weary, thou hast made desolate all my company. Ah, there you are. They told me they'd be out partying a little late tonight. All right, so we're in Job chapter 16 and verse 7. But now he hath made me weary, thou hast made me desolate all my company, and thou hast filled me with wrinkles, which is a witness against me. All right, that's why women use oil of Olay, all right? And my leanness riseth up me, beareth witness to my face. He's in pretty wretched condition, okay? All right. Now, what's going to happen with Job, as we saw earlier when he talked about the day of his birth had been blacked out and such, he is about to speak for Jesus Christ again. He's about to be prophetic and take the place of Jesus Christ on the cross. He says this, verse 9, he teareth me in his wrath, who hateth me. He gnasheth upon me with his teeth. Mine enemy sharpeneth his eyes upon me. They have gaped upon me with their mouth. They have smitten me upon the cheek reproachfully. Doesn't that strike you as Jesus Christ? Okay. Then he goes on, they have gathered themselves together against me. God hath delivered me to the ungodly and turned me over into the hands of the wicked. Keep in mind that so often for prophecy to be made, God many times had to put that prophet in a terrible place so that he could speak. And then not speak just for himself, but also for the Lord himself. When David cried out, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? We all know that's what Jesus said on the cross. Well, what was going on in David's life that he cried that out? Okay. And these are the kind of things that go on. And that's why I say, if you ever go up to the altar and tell the Lord, oh, I want to serve you no matter what. Don't be surprised if God puts you in very hard situations, very difficult, very bitter situations. And why does he do that? Well, the Apostle Paul said to fill up that which is behind in the suffering of Jesus Christ, okay? And he puts you in those situations and he molds you with those. I'm glad everybody here has had wonderful times. But yet some of the deepest and darkest and most horrible things that have happened to you have really molded you into what you are. Some of you in bitterness. And others of you in wisdom. Okay? It can go either way. Again, when everything fell apart from my family 20 years ago, I gathered my children together and I told them, I said, yeah, horrible things have happened to us as a family. And I just made the observation that over the years, I have met wonderful people. Every once in a while, you meet somebody who's wonderful above and beyond. Just this person has all the right answers, and they're kind, and they're wonderful. And you think to yourself, gosh, they must have just had this wonderful life. And then you find out, no, horrible things happen to them in their life. Okay? They chose to let those horrible things make them into a wonderful person. Then you find other people who are just vile and bitter and they're against everything and you know, and you think, gosh, they must have had a horrible life. And you find out that when mother divided the M&Ms, she gave brother an extra blue one, you know. And you know, it just can't take it and bitter and everything else. And people choose how to respond to things. Those are choices people make. One of my favorite testimonies was Tanya's, where she just talked about, and those of you who remember Tanya's earliest years here, she was an extremely hateful person. And then God took her, in God's mercy to her, he took her back in her youth to sitting, and in her mind, she remembered sitting in between her grandparents at a church service and looking around at all the people in there and choosing to hate them because no one cared for her. And then God showed her entire life based on that choice. What's it done for you, Tanya? What did it do to you as a five-year-old when you chose to hate everyone? And she had to get out of the car and puke out the old light by the side of the road on 305. You say, a choice a five-year-old made? Yeah, a choice a five-year-old child made, that she would hate everyone, okay? Because they didn't care for her. And another person in that situation might have chosen differently. Those are personal choices people make. And if you're bitter towards someone, okay, you chose to be bitter. You could have handled it different. If you've ever been turned over to bitterness, and I have been, as a saved person, turned over to bitterness. It's one of the most awful things in the world because you can't stop it when you want. It's called a root of bitterness. And if you've ever done gardening, you know full well, you can pull the tops off all the weeds in the garden and it doesn't do a bit of good. They all just pop right back up because the roots are still there. And there's certain roots you have to dig very deep down to get those out. And here's one of the things I learned about the root of bitterness. You don't have the ability to get rid of it. Only God, and there is no place in that Bible that tells you how to get rid of a root of bitterness. None. You can search, and it's not in there. The only way a root of bitterness will ever leave a person is God, in his mercy, taking that out. I've also learned this, that God will not take it out until he's convinced you will never lightly become bitter again. Because there's no point in delivering you from bitterness if you're just going to get into it all over again, okay? You're bitter because your brother-in-law cheated you when you were buying a house together 20 years ago, and now you live in rental houses, he's living in a good place, you know, and you're bitter every time you see him or something like that. If God ever delivers you from that bitterness, you'll never lightly get bitter with someone again. Again, many years ago, a man did something to me, made me very bitter when he did it. I look back now, yeah, I was foolish to get bitter. At the time, it was difficult to see it any other way. And that bitterness, it hurt me, it hurt my marriage, it hurt everybody that dealt with me. It just was an awful thing. And when God finally delivered me from it, I remember a number of years later, this, and then, man, we got along well after that. Everything was fine. And really, he did not see the decisions he made, how horrible the impact was. If he had, I don't think he would have done them. Okay? That was one of the things I had to resolve, that he didn't see that. Okay? He made some decisions and they were awful with consequences. And they hurt my pride, which is like the worst thing that happened. All right. So years later, the same man really pulled a terrible stunt again. And I remember him walking up and looking at me like, how are you going to handle this? And I just told him, you're not worth getting bitter over. You say, was that a bitter statement? No, nope, just a fact. All right? And I just did. So what? All right, you did it again. All right, so what? You know, I lived last time, I'll live this time. You know, we're just not going to get into that again. So if you're bitter over something, you better pray to God. You're not going to get rid of it. Oh, I'm done with the bitterness. No, you're not. Okay? No, you're not. And when you're sick of it, and it's ruined things for you, and it's ruining your life and everything else, maybe, God in his mercy will take that bitterness away if you want it to be gone. But I assure you, he won't do it until he is absolutely convinced you will never lightly become bitter again. Okay? Then he'll take that bitterness away from you. So it's one of those things, some of you have only been saved a year or two. It's an easy trap to fall into. Okay, allowing yourself to become bitter. Okay, very easy trap to fall into. And it hurts you so bad when you do it. All right, so don't do it. All right, so now it goes on, Job's speaking here. And he says this in verse 11, God hath delivered me to the ungodly and turned me over into the hands of the wicked. Why would God take someone he loved and turn him over to ungodly people? Well, there's a lot to be learned in that. Okay? How about people sitting in North Korea, very similar, North Korean concentration camp right now? Okay? You know, they probably think the tribulation hit. It hasn't. Okay? People used to go to church. Now they're sitting there and their children are being brainwashed. And if you ever read the book called Camp 14, it's about one of the few people to ever escape from a concentration camp in North Korea and get out. And he talks about narking on his parents and being glad they died. He's just been propagandized. Okay? They tell me today he has very severe emotional problems, even with the millions of dollars he's made off the book and everything. And you know, you just imagine that kind of life. And North Korea has two concentration camps, each one the size of Los Angeles. And some of the people are multi-generation because they believe in pollution of blood. If you were born in it, you stay in it, okay? And, you know, if a family's arrested, everyone in the family's arrested. And they just live in those. And they're turned over to the ungodly. Do you think you'd stay as a Christian that way? You think you'd be bitter with God if that happened to you? And then you get mad because your mother-in-law had a little power over you for a year. You know, or you're mad because, you know, somebody in the church got the upper hand on you. Why was I turned over to the ungodly, you know? Mm-hmm. All right. Goes on, it says in verse 12, I was at ease, but he hath broken me asunder. He hath also taken me by the neck and shaken me to pieces and set me up for his mark. His archers compass me round about. He cleaveth my reins asunder and he doth not spare. He poureth out my gall upon the ground. He breaketh me with breach upon breach. He runneth upon me like a giant. This is the wrath of the Father against this man on the cross who has become sin. Okay. God the Father hates sin, and his wrath is against it as this man, Jesus Christ, has become sin for us that knew no sin.
Are these all things that we, that even though we see them here in Job, they're unseen by the human eye in
they the are. And that's why Psalm 18 tells you he made darkness his secret place. His pavilion round about him were dark waters, thick clouds of the skies. That's why it blacked out when Jesus Christ is on the cross. A number of things happened there. One, God collects the blood. Okay? Imagine all that blood that came out. Imagine the soldier who was in charge of nailing Jesus Christ to the cross. In the morning, his wife goes to wash his clothes and there's no blood. Okay?
What about the whipper?
Well, the whipper, same thing, no blood. Okay?
Now, they had the other thieves. They might have had their blood. But if there was one that only got Jesus Christ's blood on him, his wife would have been stoned in the morning. Okay? No blood on him. All that blood was collected. All the blood that was on the cross collected. All the blood that was on the ground. How did that happen and no one see it? He made darkness his secret place. Okay? All these things that went on there, it's because it's dark. God made that darkness. It's an unearthly darkness. It's a darkness beyond anything. Yes, sir.
I want to back up and ask a question. In verse 9, he says, he's heard me in his wrath, he hated me.
Yeah.
You know, so often over the years, I've heard that God loves the sinner but hates the sin. Well, does this contradict that at all?
You know, not really. For God so loved the world, God commendeth his love toward us, and that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. Okay, so no doubt that he loves them there. But the man Jesus Christ, at that point, has been utterly turned into the man of sin.
So that's our argument.
That's right. He's been turned into the man of sin, and God has hated him perfectly. All right. So it goes on and it says this. Verse 15, I have sewed sackcloth upon my skin and defiled my horn in the dust. My face is foul with weeping, and on my eyelids is the shadow of death. Not for any injustice in mine hand, also my prayer is pure. Now that's, Jesus Christ can for sure say that. It's interesting, Job also says that, all right? But Jesus Christ could for sure say that. O earth, cover not thou my blood, and let my cry have no place. And the earth did not cover the blood of Jesus Christ. Okay. Also now, behold, my witness is in heaven, and my record is on high. My friends scorn me, but mine eye poureth out tears unto God. Oh, that one might plead for a man with God, as a man pleadeth for his neighbor. When a few years are come, then I shall go on the way, whence I shall not return. So he's slipping back into Job here. Okay. And it's always, one of the hard things in the Bible is always to tell when does prophecy quit, when does it pick up with the narrative again. I spent some time in Hosea 11 just a day or two ago. I was in my natural reading. And it's that thing where I called my son out of Egypt. And it's so bizarre to me because he's talking about how Israel went down into Egypt and then I called my son out of Egypt and it sounds like Egypt and yet the gospel tell you that was Jesus Christ coming up. And when I really looked at it, so yeah, it is a distinct different thing in that sentence. But it's always difficult to keep that track. Another thing that's difficult is typology. Okay. What do I mean by typology? Typology is when something in the Old Testament becomes like a parable. An example of that would be Noah's Ark. Was there really an ark? Yes, there was. Okay, then did God take a man-made thing made of wood and save mankind? Yes, he did. Didn't he do that with the cross? He took a man-made. See what I mean? That's what's called typology. Okay. One of the greatest types in the Bible is the man Joseph. What happened to him? His brethren put him down in a pit. And he was resurrected out of the pit. He goes into, and you know, what's that a picture of? It's a picture of death. He goes into Egypt. What's Pharaoh do? Raises him on his right hand. He's in charge of it all. It's a picture of Jesus Christ. And Joseph is one of those, the more you study his life, you start seeing these little coincidences and realize God actually wrote a little morality play into that, picturing Jesus Christ and the resurrection. And yet all typology eventually falls apart. Okay? When Abraham goes to offer Isaac upon the mountain, it's obvious, okay? That's typology, God offering his son. God even says so. So you'll find a lot of that in that Old Testament where suddenly you're reading and God will, you're beginning to see what's called the spiritual of a verse. Every verse has an historical application, but it has a doctrinal application, but it also has a spiritual application. Something, you know, David and Goliath. Historically it happened. Doctrinally, why it happened? Because David's the anointed, showing it to Israel. All right, do you have giants in your life? Okay, where you go out there and those few things that God showed you by yourself, and you go out there and fight those giants. So I took a real thing and I turned it into a spiritual lesson. Okay, so all things have that. So one of the hard things in your Bible is when you're reading something spiritually. You're looking at it, you begin to see that other picture God has. That always falls apart at some point, okay? Always at some point, it just won't work anymore. And so, but again, it's a fascinating thing when God begins to show you that stuff in the Bible, okay? All right. So he goes on, and here, chapter 17, and this is a part of a scope commercial. My breath is corrupt, my days are extinct, the graves are ready for me. Are there not mockers with me? And doth mine eye continue in their provocation? Okay. So he's talking to his friends again. All right. Are there not mockers with me? And, you know, a lot of times when you want people to pity you, they might pity you, but they don't see it like you see it. All right. You know, they might consider it your fault or something of that, or they might say it, and you're mad. You don't like that. I'm not going to say it that way. All right. And, you know, they've come to Job, and he sees them as kind of mocking or whatever else, and he's not quite liking that. They're not happy because Job won't admit he's guilty, and you're just a horrible person, and that's the only reason this is happening, Job. All right. Verse 3, lay down now, put me in a surety with thee. Who is he that will strike hands with me? A surety is when you co-sign for somebody, okay? Luke wants to get a loan, you know, and the bank says, we don't trust you, you know, do you have anybody to co-sign? So his father goes and co-signs the loan for him, okay? That's what a surety is. They would strike hands for that, you know, as a surety for somebody. All right? Verse 4, for thou hast hid their heart with understanding, therefore shalt thou not exalt them. He that speaketh flattery to his friends, even the eyes of his children shall fail. There he's talking about flattering, not in a good sense. You know, you walk up and you're just flattering your friends to get away with things, okay? Boy, you're just the greatest. By the way, can I borrow $5? You know? So, he that speaketh flattery to his friends, even the eyes of his children shall fail. He hath made me also a byword of the people, and aforetime I was a tabret. What's a byword? A byword is where people use you an example. Well, you're just another Stephen Asquith, all right? You know, you're just another Luke Morey. And, you know, that's never said in a good way, all right? Well, when we're playing croquet, and if you hit the ball and it bounces over the wicket, you Randy'd that ball, they say.
That one was rigged!
Yeah.
Sure, that's the deal.
Randy's one of the best players out there as far as physically. He never understands strategy, but as far as hitting the ball, he can do as well as anybody. But it's just one game. It was just funny. It kept happening to him. And so now, you know, they'll say, oh, you just Randy'd the ball, all right? Your name becomes a byword among the people.
Moving forward.
Yes.
Byword.
All right. All right, so, and he says, I was as a tabret. What's a tabret? Like a tambourine. All right. All right. Then he goes on and he says this, mine eye also is dim by reason of sorrow, and all my members are as a shadow. I mean, this is tough in his life right now. My eye is dim because of sorrow. You know, I can hardly even see ahead of me. I'm just so full of sorrow. I'm so full of grief. I'm not even really seeing things out ahead of me, okay? Upright men shall be astonished at this, and the innocent shall stir up himself against the hypocrite. The righteous also shall hold on his way, and he that hath clean hands shall be stronger and stronger. That's why the guys wash their hands before they go and work out in the garage out there, all right? But this really is a proverb they're using. I think they all agree with this. Just the idea, do things right, okay? Do things the right way. I was talking to my son Carl today, and he's probably going to be moving to New York. His marriage lasted less long than the Titanic, but regardless of that, you know, he's just talking about leaving, and he's got a boss he's working for, and he needs to handle it right in leaving. And again, we both agreed that you have to handle it absolutely right with him. You don't leave him in a lurch. You absolutely do everything exactly like you're supposed to do it, and you know that's the only way to do it. And you know, if you do it that way, that's where your strength comes from. Okay. You know, you can get away with sneaky little things or anything, but eventually all that stuff just gets you and it weakens you and turns you into something you don't want to be. connivers win short-term battles and always lose the long-term battles. All right. Then it goes on and it says this. Verse 10, but as for you all, do you return and come now? For I cannot find one wise man among you. How's that for being said? All right. My days are past. My purposes are broken off, even the thoughts of my heart. They change the night into day. The light is short because of darkness. If I wait, the grave is mine house. I have made my bed in the darkness. I have said to corruption, thou art my father. To the worm, thou art my mother and my sister. And where is now my hope? As for my hope, who shall see it? They shall go down to the bars of the pit when our rest together is as the dust. So he's pretty miserable. I think he's expressed that misery pretty well. By the way, if anybody wants to know, if any young men are looking for a wife, you wait for Katie Montgomery. She makes great coffee. All right. Hey, very few more important things than that, Randy. Okay.
I'm sure I could think of several given a little bit of time.
Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah. You ever seen that old... every once in a while you see it on a black a plaque or whatever, you'll see a little thing and show a man and a woman kissing, and it says, you know, something about youth and beauty don't last, but good cooking do.
Hey, man.
Yeah.
I can say amen to that.
Yep. Amen. All right. So 18, then answered Bildad the Shuhite and said, how long will it be ere you make an end of words? Mark, and afterward we will speak. In other words, shut up. Right? Now, you guys can say it, you know, you learn those things, and you can say it sometimes. How long will it be? Are you making end of words? All right. They think about it. Whereas we are counted as beasts and reputed vile in your sight. He teareth himself in his anger. Shall the earth be forsaken for thee, and shall the rock be removed out of his place? Yea, the light of the wicked shall be put out, and the spark of his light shall not shine. So he's throwing it right back at him, all right? We understand why it's so awful. You know, you're like, you're a wicked guy, and that's why everything's falling apart for you. The light shall be dark in his tabernacle, and his candles shall be put out with him. The steps of his strength shall be straightened, and his own counsel shall cast him down. Now the thing is here, he's talking about the wicked again. And remember what we said last week. When he's talking about the wicked, he's dealing with the Antichrist. These are prophecies of the Antichrist. But here he's accusing Job of being the Antichrist. All right. So he goes on and he says, verse 7, the steps of his strength shall be straightened, his own counsel shall cast him down. For he is cast into a net by his own feet, and he walketh upon a snare. The jinn shall take him by the heel, and the robber shall prevail against him. The snare is laid for him in the ground, a trap for him in the way. Terror shall make him afraid on every side, shall drive him to his feet. His strength shall be hunger-bitten, and destruction shall be ready to decide. It shall devour the strength of his skin. Even the firstborn of death shall devour his strength. You know, one of the sad things is what often happens. Go ahead.
What was that word, jinn?
Jinn is like a snare that you might catch a bird in, okay? You know, maybe you had a little loop or something, he steps in there, gets him, and that's called a jinn, okay? Good question. All right. Sometimes when you study world leaders and what happens to them, you know, Napoleon retreating from Moscow, or Adolf Hitler in his last days in the bunker, and his hands won't work or anything like that, and, you know, just sitting there, and he's calling out, send so-and-so an army. They don't even exist. He's just so high on drugs and everything. And just, it's just a miserable thing. And these guys are still walking around, still worshiping him. And he's just this mess. And it's often terrible what goes on with these people who once were of such great power and how low that they are brought. It goes on, it says this, verse 13, it shall devour the strength of the skin, even the firstborn of death shall devour his strength. His confidence shall be rooted out of his tabernacle, and it shall bring him to the king of terrors. It shall dwell in his tabernacle, because it is none of his. Brimstone shall be scattered upon his habitations. His root shall be dried up beneath, and above shall his branch be cut off.
His remembrance shall perish from the earth, and he shall have no name in the street. He shall be driven from light into darkness and chased out of the world. He shall neither have son nor nephew among his people, nor his remaining in his dwellings. They that come after him shall be astonished at his day, as they that went before were frightened. Surely such are the dwelling of the wicked, and this is the place of him that knoweth not God. That goes right along with Psalm 109 and prophesying about Judas Iscariot, about his children, and let no man, you know, give them pity. And you know, they go out and they're to be vagabonds and beggars in the world. And that's really going right along with that. All right, so Job chapter 19. Then Job answered and said, how long will you vex my soul and break me in pieces with words? Okay. How's that for a fancy way of saying, you know, you're killing me with what you're saying? These 10 times have you reproached me. You're not ashamed that you make yourself strange to me. And being indeed that I have erred, mine error remaineth with myself. All right, look, folks, if I've screwed up, it's my business, not yours. If indeed you will magnify yourselves against me and plead against me my reproach, know now that God hath overthrown me and hath compassed me with his net. There's a partial truth to that. Okay, send the devil against him. Behold, I cry out of wrong, but I am not heard. In other words, he's accusing God of doing wrong here. Okay? And there's not a person sitting here at some point in your life hasn't accused God of doing wrong to you. You'd be amazed at the people who really think that God did them wrong. All right. So he goes on and he says this. Verse 7, behold, I cry out of wrong, but I am not heard. I cry aloud, but there is no judgment. He hath fenced up my way that I cannot pass, and he hath set darkness in my path. He hath stripped me of my glory and taken the crown from my head. And there are times when God will bring you low. And when those things happen, you know, salute the darkness. God's brought you low. Learn what God wants when he's brought you low. And you know, I always go back to this thing when God took me and made me to be a man who was a castaway, who he would not use. Okay, first of all, I recognize I'm a castaway. I'm someone that God will not use. And when I would meet other preachers, they'd be, you know, I knew a lot of Bible. I might talk to them or whatever. Well, what are you? I said, well, I'm a castaway. You know, they wouldn't know what to say. They never heard a preacher call himself a castaway before. But, you know, the first thing is take your place. Okay. The best way to get out of where you are is take your place. Then I would go into other men that God made a castaway. King Jeconiah, Jehoiakim, that got sent down into Babylon and put in a dungeon. He was 8 years old when it happened. And many years later, King Evil-Merodach, that's his name, Evil-Merodach, all right, brings him out, puts him in royal clothing, and lets him eat at the table with him. All right? And I told the Lord, look what you did for him all those years pining away in a dungeon, and all of a sudden you just turned everything away in his life. I told him about Mark, that Paul said, John Mark, he's not coming with me. He ran away. I'm not taking that guy out with me. But when Paul writes Timothy, he says, bring Mark to you. He's profitable unto me in the ministry. And I tell the Lord, you turn it around for him. And one of those that I love the most is in the book of Chronicles, where it talks about those of Simeon, who in the days of Hezekiah went into this land and took it for themselves, and they dwell there to this day. And you say, wait a second. Simeon was supposed to take in his heritage way back in the days of Joshua. These are some that never did it. 400 years went on. Then in the days of Hezekiah, they finally go take their inheritance. Now the rest of Israel's in captivity in Babylon, and they're in their inheritance. So here's ones who never did what they were supposed to, but finally did, and God turned it all around for them. And I just said to the Lord, you did it for them, do it for me. Okay? You did it for them, do it for me. Turn it around. So if you find yourself where it's obvious, where no matter what you do, God's against you. So not just for short periods of time. If you've ever served the Lord, you've seen that happen, okay? Or just you try this, it doesn't work, you try that. You're not wrong in what you're trying, but God just won't bless it. It's not that you're sinful. It's not that you made a sinful decision. You've seen that, haven't you, Dale, where it wasn't a sinful decision. It wasn't even based on your
lusts or anything. He just made it, and God just won't abide to this. He just won't do anything to help it. Then later on, you understand why. Oh, that's why. All right. And tribulation worketh experience, experience hope, and hope making not ashamed. You guys have better sense now. Not that it doesn't tear you up. All right. To this day, it tears me up when God does that to me. It's not that it doesn't tear me up, but I'm more used to it. I can stand there and say to myself, well, I know that God's doing something here. I don't feel that way, but I can say it. And wait in patience for God to take care of it, whatever God's going to do with it. All right. So it says verse 9, he hath stripped me of my glory and taken the crown from my head. He hath destroyed me on every side, and I am gone, and my hope hath removed like a tree. He also kindled his wrath against me and counteth me as one of his enemies. And this really, this fits Jesus Christ. I don't remember any time that Job was ever counted as a king. All right, took his crown from him. His troops came together and raised up their way against me and encamped about my tabernacle. Certainly that happened with God, with, you know, the Roman troops taking him, as far as Jesus Christ. He hath put my brethren far from me, and mine acquaintances are verily estranged from me. My kinsfolk have failed, and my familiar friends have forgotten me. You know, and again, it's sad to me. Anybody who's ever followed Stephanie Fast, it's sad she's an older woman today, and she's pro-abortion. I saw one time where Jennifer Bailo debated with her on Facebook. But Stephanie Fast was an orphan, really not even orphan, an abandoned child in Korea during the Korean War. Her earliest memories are a long time being buried alive. And she doesn't know how she got out of it. She thinks that her real mother probably saw it and came and unburied her. But because she was half Caucasian and half Korean, she was called a Tuki, which is a devil. And even her mother couldn't keep her. And so she remembers in the summers going out with other children, catching mice and eating them and eating berries and things. And during the winter, she said it was real hard because she had to come down in the streets. And she said, you know, by the time she became an adult, she'd been raped so many times as a prepubescent girl that she was just torn to pieces inside. And you know, just every horrible thing that you can imagine, you know, has been done to her as this Tuki. And she remembered one time a bunch of men throwing her and a little girl into a building and locking the doors. And they realized there's rats in here and the rats are starving. And her just screaming, and they're attacking the little girl first. And she, again, she can't remember how she got out of that. She thinks, again, her mother probably got her out of it. She thinks her mother was always a shadow in the background there trying to protect her, even though her mother couldn't keep her. And she talked about then, at one point, the cholera epidemic hit. And again, this is the height of the Korean War, 1951 and such. This cholera epidemic hits. And she talked about finally just laying on the street and dying. And she was just so happy to be dying. And she's just laying there. And she just says, finally at peace. All her strength was gone. And she said the Swedes had put a mission there. And the Swedish nurse was sent out every day. And her job was to pick up infants off the street who'd been either their parents or died or whatever. And she said, I don't know why. She stepped over me so many times and brought me in. There's children dying all over, and for some reason the woman brought me in. And actually got in trouble for it because they didn't have provision, you know, for children. I mean, this is just how bad everything is. And but now that she's been brought in, they kept her alive. And she remembers screaming when she realized she was alive. She didn't want to live, and just screaming. And she said, even those Korean Christians couldn't love a Tuki. They had Korean Christians working in this place. Even a Korean Christian couldn't love a Tuki. And she said, but they gave me jobs to do. And she said, I would go out to the river and wash the diapers. And she said, we had 500 babies. And I would just be busy all day long, but at least they ate and things. And then she said, one day, there was going to be this day where they were going to, they said, an American is going to adopt one of these babies. And everyone was so excited. She'd never seen an American. She's so excited. And she said, you know, they did everything they could. And she was so hard, putting little bows in these little babies' hairs and trying to get them all pretty and everything. And you know, and she said, everything's together. And she said, she couldn't help but wait to see. And she, this man came in, and she'd seen Americans from afar. You know, it's a war-torn country, but never been up close to one. And she said the man came through, he was a missionary. And he came through, and he's looking at all the babies and touching each one. And finally comes in, he walks into the room where she is, and she forgot to run. She's so fascinated. And she said, he touched my face. He said, my entire life, no one had ever touched my face in love. And she said, I spit at him. She said, every man ever touched me had hurt me. She said, I don't know why he adopted me. And, you know, she gets raised in his household, but she talked about how everything was wonderful for a while. Just, oh, it's so, you know, she was just the delight of this little house, and, you know, and everybody would come, and she's just this delightful little creature, and isn't it wonderful? She said about 14 or 15, depression hit her like nothing she'd ever seen before. Imagine all that past hitting you, and she said suddenly all the clouds came back over her, and she's just so depressed. And she said the day came when her father came and sat her down and said, Stephanie, you think that you're the only one that's had all your people turn against you and your own family turn against you. And he said, keep in mind that when Jesus Christ loves you, he's not loving you from afar like some wounded dog in a cage. He has empathy where he can feel what you feel, okay? He can feel this, okay? He was acquainted with grief. He had his entire people turn against him. He had his family run away from him. He understands that. And she said, that clicked. That clicked with her. She realized that. He has gone through what I've gone through. I'm not the only one. And I've always loved that idea that when Jesus loves you, it's not just this idea, oh, I feel so sorry for Audie and for Autumn, you know. No, he actually can get in there and feel the weight, okay? Can feel the weight, okay? The Bible calls him pitiful, okay? Not that he's worried about pitiful, but no, in the sense that he can pity, okay? And he had that, and have that feeling for what you are, and he can sense that and know that and have that. And that's what Jesus Christ is. And this is really what Job is going into here and talking about. And he talks about here, and he just says, verse 13 again, he hath put my brethren far from me, and mine acquaintance and verily are verily estranged from me. My kinsfolk have failed, and my familiar friends have forgotten me. There'll come a time in almost anybody's life where you might lose your friends and all your kinfolk. None of you understands why you're doing what you're doing, okay? And they all turn from you. Now, some of you, it's almost inverse, that happened to you early in life, okay? Where everybody, you know, your kinfolk all turned to you. God may turn that around for you, okay? Dale always talks about what it's like to go into a party and none of your family wanted you there, you know? I know that feeling. Ruth Ann's known that feeling where it's not that they don't love you, but it's kind of a bummer that you showed up, all right? And it's a heavy thing. It's a hard thing to put up with that, all right? But don't be surprised if the same thing happens to you again in the bowels of Jesus Christ. Goes on and he says this, verse 15, they that dwell in mine house and my maids count me a stranger, I'm an alien in their sight. I called my servant, and he gave me no answer. I entreated him with my mouth. Do you imagine? He's actually going to talk about what it's like when things so turn on you that even the low people laugh at you. Even the low people think you're nothing, okay? And this is why I say, you go out of your way to make friends with the lowest people on earth and to be so kind to them and be so nice to them and so caring for them, because the day will come where you'll be looking up to them. And if you ever sneer to them in the least, they'll delight over it. It'll be the happiest moment in their life when you're lower than them. They'll thrill to it.
The whole comes around, goes around a bit.
Yes, sir. Verse 17, my breath is strange to my wife. My wife slugs me when that happens.
I smell that on your breath.
All right. Though I entreated for my children's sake of mine own body, yea, young children despised me. I arose and they spake against me. They're actually mocking him. Ha ha, look at Job. Ha ha ha. Okay. Let me tell you something. Children can be cruel.
But any elementary school.
Yeah, they can be very cruel. You know, you always have this picture, you think of the, you know, the boxcar children, or you hear this story, and mom and dad died, and the big sister took care of them. Oh, they're all so wonderful and that. I've learned in real life it doesn't happen that way. Okay? I've learned that in real life when awful things happen to a family, sometimes the children actually turn cruel, and they turn miserable, and they turn awful, okay? And I've learned that that's how it happens, okay?
I actually saw that happen in my high school, like, one of my old buddies, Jordan Ferris, been here since I saw him, but he told me that ever since after his mother passed, there was almost an ungodly hatred between him and his younger brother after that happened.
Yeah, it's terrible what goes on, okay? Don't be surprised if you see that happen to children and they suddenly become bitter and awful and cruel or things of that sort. It happened to Job. He says, verse 20, my bone cleaveth to my skin and my flesh, and I am escaped with the skin of my teeth. There, you ever heard that?
Mm-hmm.
There, that's a Bible phrase. Have pity upon me, have pity upon me, O my friends, for the hand of God hath touched me. And again, that's a pathetic thing when you beg people to have pity on you. You've fallen pretty low. Why do you persecute me as God, and are not satisfied with my flesh? Oh, that my words were now written. Oh, that they were printed in a book. Well, you got your way, Job. You may not like them when you read them later, but they're there, all right? All right. You know, one of the cruelest things my father ever did to me, and those of you who are children, just try this sometimes. One of the cruelest things you will ever do, okay? I was angry with him over something, and he told me, gave me a piece of paper and a pencil. He said, I want you to write down what you're saying right now. And I wrote down just what a jerk he was. And I saw it again a year later. And I remember thinking, oh my goodness, I cannot believe I wrote this. I was so humiliated to your read that you were such an idiot that you wrote those words, all right? You just try that to your children, son. Have them write down why they're mad at you, okay? Have them write it down. And they're so proud of it at the time. I'm mad at you. And then you show it to them. Even 6 months later, they'll just squirm. They'll die because they wrote that. Yes, sir?
And on the off chance, said year later, it's still the same? What then?
It won't be. Okay. I'll guarantee you. You know why you think it's the same? Because you said it with spoken words, and a week later you changed them just a teeny bit in your mind. And then a week later you change them again just a teeny bit in your mind. And a week later you change them, and by the time the next year comes, you think you're saying the same thing. Mm-hmm. And you might have some overall grudge that hasn't changed, but you'd be amazed how much it changes.
You said something to me, I don't know if it was a year ago or 2 years ago, and I had realized it, but didn't know it until you said it to me. You said something like, Ronnie of 2021, oh, I hate the Ronnie of 2020.
Yeah.
You know? And you're right, you know.
Yeah. Brandy and I talk about that, though, don't we? The idea that, you know, we'll look back at ourselves 5 years from now and hate the idiot we are now. Mm-hmm. Is there anybody here who loves what you were 5 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
You know, where you look back and say, oh, yeah, 5 years ago, I had it all together. Boy, I had... No, you look back and think, what an idiot I was. And if you just remember that 5 years from now, the person sitting there, you're going to call an idiot. You will call that person an idiot. It'll keep you from getting all full of pride, all right? You'll be a little bit more careful about the stuff you say, a little bit more careful about the opinions you throw out there, is to realize that 5 years from now, you will vote yourself to be the biggest jerk that ever lived, all right? Not the, who you are that not then, but what you are now, all right? You look back and say, what an idiot that guy was, all right? And Randy and I talk about that a lot, okay? And again, it's one of the wiser things Randy has, that he knows he'll do that. And if you know it, you'll be more careful. All right. So he goes on, and he says this, verse 24, that they were graven with iron pen and lead in the rock forever. And they are, Job. For I know that my Redeemer liveth, and this is a wonderful thing, and that he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth. And this is the common faith of the Old Testament saint, okay? And that though my skin worms destroy this body, yet in my flesh shall I see God. That is the common faith of the Old Testament saint, is they believe in a resurrection. Okay? That's why the great woman of Shunem said, it is well. She believed in a resurrection. Okay? That's that common faith. If you're looking for any one thing through all the times that have ever been, those who believe in a resurrection by the power of God. Verse 27, whom I shall see for myself, and mine eyes shall behold, and not another, though my reins be consumed within me. What are your reins? That ability to make decisions and to guide yourself inside, okay? Be ye afraid of the sword, for wrath bringeth the punishment of the sword, that ye may know there is a judgment, okay? And it's one, by the way, it's one of the most important reasons that you discipline your children. Training and discipline are two different things. A well-trained child doesn't need discipline. Discipline is when they break their training. Okay? You train a child to what he's supposed to do. What are you supposed to do when you get up in the morning? I'm supposed to take my pajamas, put them under my pillow, make my bed. You know, a couple things he's supposed to do. Okay? You go over that with him. If you'll do it for 21 straight days, where you yourself always make sure that they'll do it for life. You have to do it for 21 straight days, okay? And they'll do that. Then, finally, one morning comes, they're all excited, and maybe a new puppy downstairs or something like that, and they run downstairs and don't do it. You go upstairs and it's not done. Ah, discipline needed. You didn't do what you're supposed to do, okay? So you take care of that. So the thing is here, when children do wrong, it's so important that there be a consequence for it. It doesn't always have to be some bitter, awful consequence. One of the worst consequences is a raised voice. If the only way you can control children is with a raised voice, go to a mirror, point, and say, you are a stupid person. Okay? That's the only way that you can handle children is with a raised voice. You go to a mirror and say, you are a stupid person. Michael Pearl, and I'm not advocating all the stuff that they write and such. But the thing is, Michael Pearl points out one time of borrowing an Amish man's team of horses. And the Amish man told him, don't you yell at my horses. When I say stop, my horses stop. They just need to understand you said the word stop. Okay? When I say turn right, my horses turn right. When I say turn left, my horses turn left. Don't you yell at them. You're going to destroy my horses. Okay? And it occurred to him, well, why can't I do that with my children? Why can't I train them that when I say stop, it means stop, okay? And by the way, if you do say stop and they don't, the whole world needs to stop. Nothing else needs to go on to that house. I don't care if it takes 2 days until that child stops. You get control of that. In other words, you've lost that child and they've lost their life. You've destroyed them, okay? Most parents do it out of laziness and giving up. Oh, just go on. You've trained your children that if you do it long enough, you'll give up. Okay, you trained them that. You know, Dr. Dobson, he's got a tremendous thing he talks about with little Johnny sitting on the couch watching television. Mama walks by and says, all right, Johnny, turn the television off. Go clean up your room. Does little Johnny do it? No. She comes by later. Johnny, I told you to turn the television off. Clean your room. Does he do it? No. She comes by a little bit later. She screams, Johnny, I told you to turn the television off. You never listen to me. Throw something on the floor. I told you to clean your room. Does he do it? No. Finally, she says, Johnny, I've had enough. I'm coming in there. Stop, stop, stop. Does he turn it off? Yes, he does. Why? He's learned that that's when you mean business. When he hears those stomping, that's when you mean it. Who trained him that? You trained him that. You trained him that the first four didn't mean anything. You trained him that. All his life, he's learned that about you, that those first four times don't mean anything. So when you train a child, you start immediately. Make sure they understand. Because if you have to explain to a child why he's being disciplined, he probably didn't deserve it. Okay? Make sure they understand. Okay? Don't go in that room. And then you go in the other room, and you're pretty sure they're going to go in that room. And you just wait for them. They go in that room, you just walk in there, you grab their little hand, your little arm, you warm up their little butt. You bring them in there, you pray, it's all over again. And, you know they're going to do that, okay? You know, you've taught school. You tell them all, sit down, nobody move while I leave the room. You already know which kid's going to get up, all right? You already know which one's going to do it, you know? And And, you know, he's going to do it, and you just walk in, and you catch him, and they get, you know, or whatever else. But you train them. So when you say, don't go in that room, that means don't go in that room. And you'd be amazed how happy a child is that grows up with that kind of training. They're so happy. They're just absolutely, they're content. They always know that their parents and the adults around them are content with them. It's the most comfortable thing in the world. Or then you can go into the house where you have to tell the child five times and everybody's screaming and it's miserable and the child's miserable and everything else. And it's an awful thing, okay? The child isn't going to break that. The child isn't the one who's going to change that, okay? The parent looking in the mirror, calling himself stupid, that's the one that needs to change it, okay? And that's the only one that needs to change it. Chris and I talked the other day about having a superpower, okay? What is that? In other words, somebody says something to you that really should upset you and make you mad. You just count to 10 and don't answer. You'd be amazed what a superpower that is. You'd be amazed how that can put you all back in charge of everything again, okay? Why'd they say that to you? They want to take your superpower away. They want to turn you into a blithering idiot, all right? Works with me a lot, all right? And, but you don't have to let it. But he just said here, there's a sword that you may know there's judgment, okay? So God gave swords. He gave the power to discipline, to train. He gave it to parents. He gave it to governments. He gave it to armies. He gave it to those things that people know there's a judgment, okay? And those of you who are parents, you can prepare your children for that outside world, okay? By handling it now with patience, okay? You know, Mrs. Randall taught Ruth Ann to start that at birth. And she did. And people used to get furious with her. Mrs. Randall said, don't ever feed them on demand. The exact opposite of what every doctor said. Don't ever feed them on demand. You schedule when to feed them. And Ruth Ann would wake up and say, people are waking him up. Nope, it's time to feed him. She'd wake that child up, plop him on that breast, and and feed him. You know what? Our kids always went to sleep sooner than others did, sleep all night long and everything else. They were never, never fed on demand. They're always fed on her schedule. When she wanted to feed them, and she had to keep that schedule, she had to keep it exactly like it's supposed to. But ask the cook, you can't have a bunch of children if they're all fed on demand, all right? They always got to fit in there. The Coons children are pretty contented kids if you've ever spent time with them, okay? Are they perfect? No, they're like their dad, you know. All right? If the mother could have cloned herself, they'd have been perfect. But, you know, she debased herself and, you know, married Thaddeus Coons. But, again, it's just that idea that children are very content when there's an order into things. And people all think, well, an awful way to live. No, it's a wonderful way to live. It's such a content and wonderful way to live. Josh?
For people who like, you know, talk about how awful, you know, that would be. The problem is anytime they think of order, anytime they, you know, anytime order makes sense to them, it's when it's with a tyrannical hold over it, not a calm, peaceful hold over
exactly. it. Exactly. And it's a trap they get into. Rush Limbaugh made a statement, and I've always loved it. We've had a few people from time to time visit here. He says they're the kind of person who couldn't follow a rule if they made it themselves. You know, everybody's got a brother-in-law or an uncle or a friend or somebody like that. All right, let's go ahead and Dale, would you close us in prayer, please?
Thank you for tonight. Thank you for getting everybody here safely. And I ask that you help us return home safely. Thank you for passing the priest down. May we take heed to it, Lord, and do something with it, my God. And I thank you for what you've already started in the people's lives here. Thank you for what you're going to continue to do. Pray for those who are lost, Lord. I pray for the meetings that are getting ready to start this week. May we prepare our hearts, Lord. And we should have been doing that, getting ready for the preaching, getting ready for what you might have to say, Lord. Just ask that you continue to help us to take that serious, Lord, and be able to prepare ourselves for what's coming up this week in meeting. We thank you already for what you've begun. In Jesus' holy and precious name, we do pray, Lord. Amen.